you. Thank you. So here we are, together again on this very interesting night, at this very interesting time of the year. It's so arbitrary, isn't it? You know, there are beginnings and endings, moment to moment to moment, and yet, this is the one we call the big one. So this time of year, this very much is the season of change, of really noticeable change, isn't it? It stands out. It stands out to me, this season of cold and dark nights, of the longest night of the year. And when the light and the warmth goes out, and often don't you find that when the physical, the external light and warmth goes out, wanes, that it often triggers the waning of the inner light and the inner warmth. It seems to be that way for so many of us. This very much is a time with all this change, external change. This is a time of challenge and uncertainty. And I think we compensate. We try to compensate. It's no coincidence what happens at this time of year. All the partying, all the lights, all the food and drink, all the gifts and the gathering. That's what this season is known for. And I think it's all meant to warm us and to lighten us up. But maybe why we're all here, instead of out there with all of that, is because we really see how the lights and the gaiety tend to eliminate the darkness, tend to illuminate the depth of the darkness instead. And so there are those two words, the light and the dark, the lightness, the darkness, so strongly associated with this time of year, especially in northern countries. And what a good example of how words can be infused with subtle unconscious conditioning. These words that may have had their origin before conscious recollection. The light, quote, the light, metaphorically, often represents goodness. It often represents purity and what we seek, enlightenment, wisdom. What's the icon for wisdom? The light bulb going on. The heavenly realms. And the dark, its apparent polarity, often represents, quote, the bad. What is unclear, what is muddied, sinister and evil forces, hell realms. The Dark Ages, what we call the Dark Ages, that was a time of struggle, of the plague, of ignorance, of death. And I think some of these references maybe stem from the medieval church and the medieval church's interpretation. But it amazes me how these references, these perceptions of light and dark still carry these meanings however subtly, but often in very gross forms. And it's amazing to me because we know better. If we look closely at our experience, I think we can put an altogether different face on the perception of dark and light, on our experience of dark and light. If we think outside the box of these cultural conditionings, we know light can be too light, too bright. It can jar us. It can blind us. It can burn us. The word light, sometimes spelled L-I-T-E, can mean superficial or a lack of depth or strength. And darkness. Can we unpack darkness in a different way to see the productive womb of the earth as incubator of seeds and of life? The moist, squishy mud that gives birth to the lotus, which is a symbol of spirituality. I mean, how many of us have experienced how dukkha, how despair, suffering, how that often leads us to understanding, how it often leads us to the light. How many retreats have you all sat and it's been just pleasant and easy, and how many insights come from that versus how many insights that really have the power to transform us come from periods of a struggle of so-called darkness. Dark also gives rest, and it grows life. And so with the change of seasons, with the solstice, can we see them as a metaphor for dukkha, for change, for unreliability, for angst, and the inevitability of it? The passing of the light into darkness, which then brings the passing of the darkness into light. The turning of the wheel, the changing of the seasons, seeing that the cycle of life includes life and dying, and then regeneration. And so feeling into the inevitability of that. Joanna Macy was interviewed on the CBC radio program Tapestry. How many of you are familiar with that? This was in 2006, and she was just wonderful, and I took some notes, and I just wanted to read you a little bit from what she said on the program. Don't be afraid of the dark. Whatever you feel, whatever you are feeling, it's imperative to feel it. So feel the fear. Feel the rage. Feel the uncertainty. And isn't this what the practice asks of us? Don't analyze it. Don't intellectualize it. Don't have a story around it. What's the experience in the body? Don't be afraid of it. Open to it. She said, we are never separated from the web of life. Dark and light are both woven into the web of life. Not letting the fear out, or not connecting with the fear, isolates us. It saps our creative energy. Fear and rage are not private. They are an appropriate response to the political, environmental, social situation in the world today. She said that in 2006. So, in the world today, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. A friend of ours and co-teacher, Mark Coleman, in referencing solstice and New Year's, asks the question, how is it to stand in the unknown? How is it to stand in the darkness? So I think those of us here, we here, cultivating an intention to live an ethical life, those of us whose, you know, very serious intentions and efforts are to embody the Buddha's teachings of wisdom and compassion and non-harming. Many of us are questioning what it means to live and to practice amidst all the disturbing events in the wider world. It feels dark. Confusion and uncertainty and fear and exhaustion seem to exemplify our present experience. And isn't that just exacerbated by the whole way that things are communicated to us so viscerally through all the electronic devices? It's in our face. It's in our ears. It's such an so difficult to be present with. So what does it mean to live skillfully? What informs our practice? How can we support ourselves and others, those near and dear to us, and those in our communities, and our global sisters and brothers? We're all asking these questions. And I think asking them of ourselves and asking them in community is important. It shows that we're intricately connected to what is happening in the larger sphere of community and world. It shows we care. How wonderful is that? It shows we care. And that is an important step leading to wise intention and wise action. And it also shows that we're living with uncertainty and discomfort. This is the first noble truth, to recognize, to feel, and to understand dukkha. And something else I think needs to be considered, because many of us really want to participate and are participating in the ending of dukkha, in the ending of all kinds of suffering in the world around us. But how many of us are overextended and exhausted and weary of feeling hopeless and helpless in the presence of all the serious demands on us as individuals, as teachers, as family members, in a world that is filled with injustice and violence and poverty? So maybe one of the ways that we can take care of ourselves and model for others what that means, let's prioritize what's actually possible, which means letting go of some things. So as Norman said last night, part of intention is renunciation. What can we let go of in order to make space for taking care of ourselves so that we can go out into the world on whatever level we feel we would like to respond? Too much is not good, even when the much feels important. Please, please, let's be inspired by the waxing and the waning of the moon. There's both there. By the rise and the fall of the tides, by the changing of the seasons, there are times for full-on energy and engagement, and also times for quiet revitalization and reflection. And aren't they each important, and doesn't one make the other possible and needed? Let's please remember that the Buddha's teaching, with birth as condition, aging, so being born with that as a condition, which we all share, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair comes to be. Such is the whole mass of suffering. So to be embodied is to be alive is to know despair and loss and frustration and angst. Ad nauseam. This is the human condition. And we are not alone in this experience. Thankfully, we are not alone. And to feel the pain of suffering, our own and that of others, is what can wake us up to wise intention and wise action, as well as waking us up to our limitations. I was particularly touched by an article shared with me by a friend. It's an article written by Margaret Wheatley in a response to her anxiety and despair about the world's condition. A quote by Rudolf Barrow, and I'm not familiar with him, touched her as much as it touches me. He said, "When the forms of an old culture are dying, the new culture is created by a few people who are not afraid to be insecure." And she asks, could insecurity, could self-doubt be a good trait? She said, "I find it hard to imagine how I could work for the future without feeling grounded in the belief that my actions will make a difference." You know, wanting that certainty. But Barrow offers a new prospect that feeling insecure, even groundless, might actually increase my ability to stay in the work. And she goes on to quote Thomas Merton, the late Catholic mystic, who clarified further the journey into hopelessness. In a letter to a friend, he advised, "Do not depend on the hope of results. You may have to face the fact that your work will be apparently worthless and even achieve no result at all, if not perhaps results opposite to what you expect." How many times have we talked about, have you heard, let go of attachment to outcome? As you get used to this idea, you start more and more to concentrate not on the results, but on... but on the value, the rightness, the truth of the work itself. You gradually struggle less and less for an idea, and more for specific people. In the end, it is the reality of personal, No, don't excuse me. Join me. It is the reality of personal relationship that saves everything. She says Thomas Merton was right. We are consoled and strengthened by being hopeless together. We don't need specific outcomes. We need each other. And here we are. So back to the question, how do we stand in the darkness? And how do we stand in uncertainty? Together, as we're doing here. The Buddha had great regard for Sangha, for like-minded community. He says it is the whole of the holy life. So tonight we'll gather later this evening. It used to be near midnight, but we're getting old. We will gather to witness and to share the ending of the so-called old year and the birth of the new. And this could happen on any evening, in any moment, right? We're going to share the turning of the wheel, opening to its wholeness and hopefully our own in the heart of community, as communities have done for thousands of years, gathered and danced to keep the physical and metaphorical light and spirit alive. I like the reference of the turning of the wheel to express the cycles of life. The wheel is round and inclusive and is interdependent with all the spokes that radiate within. So to me, it's a symbol of wholeness and interdependence and inclusivity. And I wish we could reconcile all of us, each of us, with our wholeness. The inner darkness as well as the light. I wish we could reconcile with it without clinging, without taking it up as me or mine or I. Seeing it instead, this sense of darkness or this sense of light, as perhaps just another arising and passing due to conditions. I wish we could reconcile with our wholeness. When we open to it, it has the possibility of changing and transforming. Can we also see a different side of the fear and the anger, the despair? Isn't that what drives us, what spurs us to speak out and take action? And when we collectively speak out, there's an energy to action and change beyond what an individual self can do. It's like what we experience here in the meditation hall, collectively versus sitting at home alone. So let's share the joy and the sorrow. Let's inspire others and comfort others. Let's let ourselves be inspired and comforted. Let ourselves be afraid. So this longing that particularly shows up at this time of year of endings and beginnings and times of transition, to begin again, to renew, to move on effectively and unencumbered in a fresh way. We want to move on to the new, to opportunity. We want to move on to the next breath, to the next moment. But sometimes there's a sense of something holding us back. And sometimes it's very clear what it is, and sometimes it's just an intimation. And maybe it's our impatience or confusion or preoccupation with some aspect of our life, our relationship to family or to work or to a particular stress or struggle, maybe a sense of helplessness. You know, maybe it's just our narrative that clouds the seeing clearly, that clouds, you know, that really brings out the fear and the resentment that we sense is holding us back. It can do that by closing off the heart, by keeping us stuck in place. As I said before on this New Year's retreat, I love the fact that the month of January is named after the Roman god Janus. One face faces backwards, and the other face faces forwards. So indicating this time of the year, symbolizing the perceived transition of New Year's Eve. And it brings to mind for me the sense that if we are preoccupied or burdened or blinded by the past, it's really hard to fully face the present, it's hard to fully face the future. It's hard to fully face the coming year. It's hard to take that step. And I see over and over again how the meditation practice supports us in opening and in non-clinging. It supports us in compassion, and it supports us in renewal. How many times, in terms of sitting practice, you know, let's begin again. Let's begin again. This is a new moment. You can say this is a new year. This is a new opportunity. And when I reflect on the meditation practice, and I reflect on the metta practice, the loving kindness practice, the practice of friendliness, friendliness to all beings and all things. Isn't it about reconciliation? Isn't it about making peace with how I am in this moment? How making peace with this moment and whatever it holds? Reconciliation means to restore to friendship. To restore the sacred. It's about allowing wholeness, allowing inclusivity, not pushing anything outside, not pushing away anything. So practicing reconciliation is the aligning and softening of the heart-mind to be reconciled with this moment just as it is in its wholeness. Imagine reconciling with life itself. Reconciling to life as it truly is. Reconciling to dukkha as part of being embodied, which means reconciling to personal suffering, to fear, anger, loss, limitations, global suffering, famine, war, exploitation, natural disasters, injustice. Reconciling to anicca, to impermanence, to aging and death and separation from what we love. Imagine reconciling to anatta, non-separateness, reconciling to unasked for change, for not being in control. Imagine reconciling with life, with nothing excluded. To be gently present, to live in harmony without grasping, without aversion, with all people, with all life, with all conditions in our experience, without needing to lean towards or away from or excluding any part of the moment and its experience. It's not condoning anything. It's restoring to friendship. It's restoring to wholeness. So right now, can we open to making peace with the past? Of who is more right and who is more wrong and who deserves blame? Can we put down the burden of struggle and make room for renewal and wise action? Can we allow acceptance, which may include taking responsibility for one's actions? Can we let go of preference? Can we allow patience and forgiveness and reconciliation, which are all expressions of non-attachment and generosity? The forgiving and reconciling not as approval or submission or passivity, not to silence or deny the raw emotions or tragic occurrences, but as a willingness in the heart to perhaps begin to let go of the struggle and move on. Can this be our New Year's celebration and consecration, meeting ourselves and each other with forgiveness and reconciliation, allowing and fostering healing and wholeness, welcoming all of us as part of the whole? So I'd like to end, as I do every New Year's, with a few minutes of guided reconciliation practice, with bows to Philip Moffat, who is the person who authored this years and years ago. So just taking a minute to restore to friendship and harmony how you're holding the body so you can sit with ease. So let's begin by breathing into a moment of receptivity and kindness, without conditions, as much as possible, without limitations. Breathing into a moment of friendship and reconciliation, despite differences, respecting differences. Staying steady and grounded in the body while breathing happens naturally. And now letting the attention rest gently in the heart area, really being respectful of whatever sensation or emotion or energy or numbness may be showing there. Opening gently to the wish and intention for reconciliation. Reconciliation without exclusion, without conditions. Saying the phrases that I will speak slowly and silently to yourself while feeling into the heart and feeling into the phrases. May all friends and enemies be reconciled. May all teachers and students be reconciled. May all communities and their members be reconciled. May all fathers and daughters be reconciled. May all mothers and sons be reconciled. May all mothers and daughters be reconciled. May all fathers and sons be reconciled. May all brothers and sisters, sisters and sisters, and brothers be reconciled. May all mothers and fathers be reconciled. May all husbands and wives, wives and wives, husbands and husbands, lovers and partners be reconciled. May I be reconciled with myself as I am in this moment. May I be reconciled with myself as I was today and yesterday. May all beings everywhere be profoundly reconciled with themselves and with life in this very moment. May it be so.